As voters head to the polls on Tuesday, we wrap up our candidate conversations by catching up with Republican candidate for U.S. House Dusty Johnson. He stopped by the SDPB studio last week. Let's start here with the fact that after a certain amount of time of campaigning, the act of campaigning changes the candidate somewhat, I would think. Is that true? Have you been changed at all by the act of campaigning, by the process of being in the parades, shaking the hands, visiting with people, crafting policy? How has it changed who you are as a candidate?
Well, I'm sure I have changed. I don't, you know, at the conscious level, I don't know that I feel it day to day. I mean, there have certainly been some eye-opening surprises, and so that probably, those surprises probably impact me in ways I haven't fully unpacked yet. But people are nicer than you expect. I mean, we hear how terribly polarized this country is. But when you go stop into a cafe, or when you go shake hands at a parade, or when you're standing outside of a football game just saying hi to people as they go in, almost nobody is rude. I mean, a certain number of people say, oh, I'm voting for the other guy, or might not want to shake your hand, but everybody smiles. Everybody's pretty nice. Now, that is very different from what you get online. That's a secondary surprise, which is as nice as people are in the flesh. Man, can they be mean online? And that has probably changed me less than it maybe has my wife and my kids.
Right. How does it affect a family that sort of has to learn, you know, this is what's going to happen now and in the future?
Yeah, I read a psychology paper once years and years ago that says any data point we hear, even if we know it's false, changes what our mind thinks about that topic. Mm-hmm. And so if you hear a data point that is false, even though it's a false data point, it's sort of a subtle little invisible thumb on the scale of how your brain processes information. That's what's so diabolical about what the Russians or other cyber terrorists do when they try to undermine our democracy, when they are flooding the zone with false information and to delegitimize how Americans view their institutions. It's really nefarious. Well, on a more human level, you know, if my wife hears somebody say that I'm a crook or reads that, she knows I'm not a crook. She knows what a Dudley Do-Right, straight arrow kind of square I am. But it's still, it can make people a little sad. Not so much because, I mean, nobody's going to cry for the politicians, right? I mean, you know, we were the ones who chose to run for Congress. But it does make you a little sad that people, humanity, can be that mean. I mean, we should really start by being nice to each other.
But if it's happening to you, it's happening to us too. So even though you might say nobody wants to cry for the politicians, I think lots of people would say, see, that's what it is like. That's what, the algorithm of Facebook is doing, for example.
To a 14-year-old? Or what about to a person who just lost their support system and so doesn't have the kind of the girded, you know, support network? And
how would you take that message to Washington? Because are there policy changes that, you know, knowing what you know personally and also from a policy standpoint, what kind of conversation needs to be had in Washington? Everything from cybersecurity and outside forces spreading disinformation to the simple act of polarization and division that is, what's happening to free speech online.
It's toxic. Yeah. Well, I think the biggest piece is leading by example. And I have tried to be very careful. I'm sure I've failed in little ways, but I've tried to be really careful in being a decent human being. And the way I message about issues, the way I message about people, and when I disagree with them, I try not to be disagreeable. If we get enough of us to do that, we can kind of blot out, you know, the anger. And I've never been in combat, thank goodness, but my friends who have been in combat have told me that if you've got somebody on your right side and somebody on your left side that is holding their line, it makes it a lot easier for you to hold theirs. And if I'm, you know, lucky enough to get elected, I want to be one of the people who holds my lines with some decency, some comity, some collegiality, to not just grab somebody on the other side and say terrible things about them on cable news because it might earn me a vote.
Mm. You can't fight cyber war just by being nice, though. So from a policy standpoint, mm-hmm. cybersecurity, do you have, you know, is that an important issue in Washington right now, do you think, for all of us?
It is. There are two big steps. I mean, the first is we really all do have to acknowledge that there are countries and at the sub-country level, individuals and organizations that do not like America and they want to see America destabilized. And they are our enemies to a far greater extent than, you know, a particular type of Republican or a particular type of Democrat is our enemies. I mean, those are fellow Americans, right? But there are people who, you know, and the Russian government would be the most notorious example, who want to do us harm. And so number one is acknowledging we have a problem and that this isn't made up. The second thing we have to do is invest heavily and in a smart and robust way in anti-cyber, you know, in we need to up our cybersecurity infrastructure. And we can't, of course, we need the B-21 bomber, and it's really important to have the New Age bomber, but we can't just focus on fighting the last five wars. We also have to fight the next five. And to an increasing degree, that is going to mean hiring lots of very smart people who can help to keep us safe.
And to that point of holding the line, you have seen many leaders in Congress sort of struggling with how to respond to President Trump when he tweets something or says something. You know, they don't want to be overreactive, but they also are being challenged on not saying enough about decency and respect and civil discourse. What do you think the role, if voters send you to Washington, of a congressman from South Dakota will be in regards to just things the president says that are unpalatable, offensive, possibly dangerous?
Yeah, it is a really hard thing to calibrate because there's a, I mean, as a candidate, I could have, outrage is too strong a word, but I could spend much of any day pushing back against Donald Trump or Maxine Waters or Mitch McConnell or Nancy Pelosi. I mean, people of every stripe or party, they're saying things that lots of, particularly on cable news, people will have outrage about. And I don't want that to be, for me, I try not to let that be the daily distraction. I mean, we should be talking about infrastructure in this country. We should be talking about 40 million adult Americans with mental health problems. And when the president does something that's indefensible, like call somebody a horse face, that has a tendency to gobble up an entire news cycle. And so we lose yet another opportunity to talk about the important rather than just the urgent. On the other hand, you don't want to just be ignorant or uncaring when people say coarse and counterproductive things. And so when I'm asked, I always try to acknowledge if something that is said was wrong. I try to say it's wrong, and I try to reframe the issue in a more productive and helpful way. But Laura, you're right. It's really hard to know. I mean, do I raise my hand once a week, once a day, once a month? It kind of depends on how egregious the statement is.
Let's talk about, should voters send you to Washington, what some of those first things, you know, explain to us how it works or what you know so far about how it works. Do you get to choose committees? Do people choose that for you? What's the process if voters pick Dusty Johnson? What happens the very next day? How do you get ready? How do you get spun up?
Yeah, the very next week, they have an orientation for all new members of Congress. And I think that's where they talk to us about a lot of these things. So I'm not an expert, but I'll tell you what I know. You know, you don't get to pick your committees. You indicate some preferences. There are three tiers of committees. The A committees are the most prestigious, most powerful, and you only get to be on one committee if you have an A committee. So for instance, when Kristi Noem moved to Ways and Means, she had to give up all of her other committee assignments. Now, you've got B committees, which are the next most prestigious, and then you've got C committees, which are the others. And a new freshman in Congress probably would get a B committee and a C committee, and they would indicate their preferences, but there'd be no guarantee that they would get what they want. I want two B committees. That's maybe a bit of a stretch, but I feel because I'm a policy guy, because I'm a hard worker, and I think a certain number of my colleagues in Congress will acknowledge that. I mean, I'm going to work my tail off to get on agriculture and get on transportation and infrastructure. I've talked to some leaders on those committees to let them know that my background's a good fit with those, and those are important to this district, to this state. So I haven't been just waiting around for Election Day. Those two committees are huge, at least for this state they are.
We left a farm bill on the table, didn't we? So, and I talked to Senator John Thune about that. He said, you know, those staffers are working on hammering out compromises. And as soon as that new class of lawmakers comes in, we're hoping to get something on the president's desk soon. So, again, we're being hypothetical. Voters send you to Washington. How do you, what are you looking for in compromises from the farm bill? Because you're going to have to hit the ground running with that right away. And there were some pretty significant policy differences between the House and Senate bills.
Yeah, I am really optimistic they're going to get that done relatively early in 2019. I mean, I've done an exhaustive analysis of both versions of the Farm Bill. I've talked to leaders of the Ag Committee on the House side. I've talked to the Secretary of Agriculture, Sonny Perdue. I mean, I've already started to let my opinions about different components be known to people. But the Senate version got more votes than any Farm Bill in the history of the Senate. I mean, it was not perfect, but it was a really, really good Farm Bill. And John Thune does not get enough credit for what he did. He has been talking about specific policy components of the Farm Bill for 2 years. It's been remarkable. And this, they don't want people to call it a short-term CRP, but that's the easiest way for the non-Aggies in your listening audience to understand it. It's something more flexible rather than locking down, idling a piece of ground for conservation for a long time. People can do it for a shorter term period. That's all John Thune. That's all Lynn Churchman, his office. I mean, that was the team that pushed it, and they did a really good job. And so the House version was less bipartisan. It wasn't really bipartisan at all in the final vote. There were some bipartisan components that went into it. But I really believe that we're gonna get a good Farm Bill and something we can be proud of.
Are there things from the House bill that you think people need to sort of think about? Look at that Senate bill. That's a little bit more bipartisan. We have a better chance of agreeing and passing. Are there things in the House bill from a policy standpoint that you think are just not going to make it through a compromise?
The House version made it easier for certain large entities to receive support. Now, the Senate in general constricted eligibility. People get nervous about too many of these, commodity dollars and crop insurance, subsidies going to really, really large outfits. And in general, the House version lists those limits or relaxes them. It's going to be a little harder to get that through. But maybe the Senate is a little too constrictive. It may be, as things often go in Washington, that they're going to end up somewhere in the middle and that'll be okay. The House really, really likes having some work requirements for people who are on food stamps. And I really like that too. I mean, I do think if you are an able-bodied non-senior with no children in the home, young children in the home, that, working 20 hours a week is, that's not punishment. I mean, that's what many of us do and how we improve the state of our lives. But I wouldn't destroy the entirety of the Farm Bill because I didn't get my way on that component. I mean, running a country is a lot like running a marriage or running a church or running a nonprofit or running a business. Nobody gets a whole loaf when you come to the table. And if you get a whole loaf, then you are in an abusive situation and you're the bully.
All right, let's talk about the economy because we spoke to an economist this week with the economic outlook predicting the benefits of the GOP tax cut are going to start to fade a little bit. Mm-hmm. Some of the, the bill is due already. Mm-hmm. So what do you think is next for economic policy? I know the debt, the deficit concerns you.
Well, the deficit absolutely concerns me. I mean, we're headed toward $1 trillion a year deficit. That's pretty hard to defend. And I do think that the tax cuts did a lot to increase economic activity in this country. I mean, 4% growth is something a lot of us felt was out of reach. So that much is good. But if we just stop there, we've made the debt a lot worse over time. We do need some hard conversations about spending. And anytime you do that, you're going to irritate constituents, whether you bring a conservative approach toward, the Republicans want to cut a certain number of things, the Democrats want to cut different types of things, right? We're probably going to need some things from both sides of the aisle if we're really going to get spending under control. Everybody wants to beat up on discretionary spending, but you could get rid of every single dollar of discretionary spending, literally every single dollar, and you wouldn't close the national deficit. That's how big it is every single year.
So one of the fears and the criticism that was going around before those tax cuts was the tax cuts will happen, the wealthy will benefit, and then when the bill comes due, programs will be cut. So is that what you're talking about right there? Now it's time to look at that spending and do exactly what people who were opposed to it were afraid of.
Yeah, I mean, I think we want to make sure that I'll back up a half a step. I mean, Albert Einstein said the most powerful force in the known universe was compound interest. And that's kind of funny to hear a physicist talk about a financial metric like that. But what he's really talking about is you can make small changes and over time they can have a massive impact. That's compound interest. And similarly, we should not be making cuts to people who are on, Medicare today or on Social Security today. you know, if you're Dusty Johnson's age, 42 years old, I think we need to have a national conversation about if I'm going to live 20 years longer than my grandparents, you know, should all of that 20 years be in retirement? Or maybe should I work an extra 18 months to gain an extra 18 and a half years of retirement? And if you make relatively modest tweaks like that, and do it far enough down the road so that you're not imposing any real burdens on people today, you can have massive trillion-dollar impacts that add greatly to the sustainability of this country's pocketbook. We've done it before in the 80s. Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan, in a bipartisan way, tweaked the retirement age, and they added decades to the sustainability of Social Security. It's probably time for us to do something like that again from a bipartisan way.
What kind of support, advice have you gotten from other, you know, from Senator Thune, Senator Rounds, Congresswoman Noem? How have they helped you prepare for not only the campaign, but potential service in Washington?
They've been really remarkable. I mean, sometimes we forget that these are real people, right? I mean, these are not just, political celebrities, but these are people who have, you know, favorite Beatles songs and favorite flavors of ice cream. And sometimes they go to bed angry at themselves because they said something stupid, or they have things that they are lack confidence in. And so one of the best things that those three people have done to me is when I have lacked confidence, when I've been, you know, frail, they've kind of coached me up. You know, no, you really, this is something you could be good at. Mm-hmm. You really are enough of a policy guy where you, and it's not hopeless. I mean, that's probably a big thing they've done, Lori, is just remind me that we act like nothing gets done in Washington, D.C. But if you're really paying attention, it's kind of remarkable how much gets done. And it still matters who runs this country, and it isn't easy. But what's our alternative? I mean, if we don't want to work a little harder, then I guess the alternative is giving up. And I think, say what you will about Mike Rounds and John Thune and Kristi Noem, they're not perfect. But you got to give them credit for the fact that none of them give up. And I think they've told me time and time again that they think there's a place for me to be effective.
What's your favorite Beatles song?
Well, the whole of Abbey Road is fantastic. And so it'd probably be the B side of Abbey Road, that medley, the Abbey Road medley, you know, your Golden Slumbers. It's just a Polythene Pam. It's great. I mean, it doesn't get any better than that.
At what favorite ice cream was that next?
Oh, vanilla. But that's so boring. I hate to say it. It
of seems, course it is.
it seems so Republican. I mean, I don't have anything better than that.
What keeps you up at night when you can't sleep? Is it something that you said that you wish you had done differently, or is it a problem that you feel like you have to solve, and there's a real sense of urgency to it? What keeps you tossing and turning at night?
About the only thing that keeps me tossing and turning is when I have little acts of unkindness. And I am a good person, but I periodically will lose my patience and say something I don't mean to say to my kids or to a coworker. And I probably get high-centered on that stuff to a greater degree than I do. That's how we get better, though, too. That's how we get more sensitive. That's how we get more understanding. Sort of external threats really don't bother me. I mean, for whatever reason, I don't lose sleep about that. I mean, what I lose sleep with is how imperfect I am in any given day, and I know I need to be better.
The first time you and I talked about this campaign was the day of the Parkland shooting.
Mm-hmm.
And we sort of sat and put our hands up and said, what now? And you talked about people being kinder to each other and treating each other better. And now as you come in this week, it's the week of a shooting at a synagogue in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
And talk a little bit about how, when you see these mass shootings, when you see, you know, anti-Semitism, when you see gun violence, when you see what's happening with those kind of incidents, where's the first place that you think we need to put resources and effort to solve this problem? Where do you begin?
Yeah. Well, it really does come down to, I mean, resources are a big part of the equation, and in two ways. You know, of course, our minds immediately go to government, and clearly we really do need, I mean, I'm a limited government conservative, but we do need more mental health resources in the country. We can't just talk about it. We really need to do it. I mean, you know, if you told me, I don't remember the number, so I'll talk about it in a general sense, but if you told me that 64 of our 66 counties were rated as critically deficient for mental health resources, I would say, oh yeah, of course, that sounds exactly right. You simply don't have the kinds of resources in Fulton and Mobridge and Ipswich and Miller that, you'd have to have and that we have in Sioux Falls. And so there is a role for more governmental spending in mental health. And I don't deny that. But the other way that resources, this other piece is more uncomfortable for all of us because it's a little bit harder than just writing a bigger check to Uncle Sam. One of my best buddies, Joe Childs, is the principal of Mitchell High School in Mitchell, and that's where I live. And he gives little coupons for free chocolate chip cookies to any student who comes up and talks to him at school. And so you'd think, well, why? And you know, I mean, so they can go get chocolate chip cookies at the snack bar. Well, why would he do that, right? And he says, well, if I don't do that, they don't talk to me. And it's amazing how many different types of students in any day will come talk to the principal if they realize that there's chocolate chip cookies involved. And he says, people ask me a lot, why do I care if they're talking to me? And he said, if they don't talk to me, I don't know those kids. And if I don't know those kids, I can't tell when they're starting to drift away. And it's when they drift away that they become more and more likely to hurt themselves and to hurt other people. And it's remarkable. And it demands a lot from him. And it's not the cost of chocolate chip cookies. It demands that he invest a lot of time away from his iPhone and away from the selfish desires that he has and how to spend his time. And he's actually got to invest in these kids. Well, you know, are any of us doing enough of that? I mean, how many really meaningful connections did we make with people today as we rushed from one item on our to-do list to another, or as we decided we were going to binge watch an entire season of news, of a television show? And I know that's a pretty, it's hard to put, okay, politician, you know, thanks for dumping this in our lap. But if we think that this is somebody else's job, we're never really going to get where we need to go. I mean, 100 people died yesterday from suicides. And there isn't anything a bump stock is going to do about that, or the outlawing of bump stocks are going to do about that. 60% of the people who die in this country from firearms commit suicide. And I'm not doing enough. And almost nobody else is either.
Dusty Johnson, thank you so much for stopping by today.
Oh, yeah. No, thank you. And thank you to your listeners who care about elections. Oh, my goodness, do they matter?
Republican candidate for U.S. House Dusty Johnson stopped by the SDPP studio in Sioux Falls last week. You can hear our conversation with Democratic candidate Tim Bjorkman. That's on our website at listen.sdpb.org.